Thanks. All right. Good morning. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, specifically 244103 Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is Tuesday, July 26, 2016, and the time is 9 a.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Aspen Conference Room on the third floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. I am Deputy Secretary of State Suzanne Steyert. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on June 25th, 2016. Here with me today, Andrea Geiger from the Department Rulemaking Manager, Administration Division, and Melissa Polk, Legal Unit Manager, Elections Division. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign and political finance rules. As stated in the notice, the purpose of the rulemaking is to consider rule revisions necessary to ensure proper administration of legislation recently passed by the Colorado General Assembly, establish uniformity in the administration of current law, eliminate obsolete provisions, remove rules stricken by the courts, remove references to repealed statutory provisions, simplify the language of existing rules, remove language that is duplicative of statute or constitutional provisions, ensure consistency with department rulemaking standards. Secretary of State released a preliminary draft of proposed rules with the notice of rulemaking on July 20, 2016. Revised proposed draft rules were made available to the public. Both drafts are available on the office website. Copies of the notice of rulemaking, revised draft statement of basis, and revised draft rules are available on the table in the back of the room. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. This meeting is audio recorded and all comments become a part of the official legal record. This hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify at the hearing, there are sign-up sheets on the table at the back of the room. You must sign up in order to testify. For the record, our office has received written comments on the proposed rules. As we receive comments, they become a part of the official record of this hearing and are posted online. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data views or arguments or on amendments to the campaign and political finance rules in writing and, if desired, orally. This hearing is scheduled to conclude by 11. All right. That moves us to testimony. And Mr. Arnold, you're the only person signed up to testify today. So if you want to come up, just identify yourself and...
Good morning. My name is Matt Arnold. I'm the director of an organization called Campaign Integrity Watchdog, which is an aggressively nonpartisan organization dedicated to, as the name says, integrity in our campaign finance and conduct of campaigns in Colorado. I was just looking through, and again, a quick question on the adequacy of the notice. My understanding is that the notice and what is supposed to be commented on should be posted 10 days prior to a hearing. Did I get that timeline wrong, or is it?
Well, we put out the general notice. I can't remember what day.
Right, but the general notice was posted with adequate time, I believe, but what we're commenting on was only posted a week ago today.
5 days,
okay. Just wanted to clarify that because my understanding is that it was 10 days in general, so I've not had a lot of time to look over the revised rules. I think my written comment probably spoke more, in fact, I think it spoke pretty much entirely to the draft that was posted at the time and may or may not be apposite to the revised draft.
And we'll be leaving the comment period open through August 2nd, so if you have other comments as you go through it, you can submit
Fair enough.
Those.
I did have a question. One thing that did not change, and this is really more of a question to all of you, with the redefinition of Rule 1.1, redefining ballot measure, will that or how will that impact any court rulings relating to ballot questions and relating ballot questions to recall elections?
How will it affect court rulings?
Right, or the interpretation of court rulings and the rules.
Go ahead.
Sure. So the definition of ballot measure was not changed in the rules. There was a missing quotation mark.
Oh, okay.
And that's all we added.
That's not a significant change then. Fair enough. And I also had a question about Rule 1.3. The current rules include federal PACs in the listing of entities defined as a committee under Colorado law. And Removing that from the listing of what constitutes a committee, I think, could be problematic, as noted in my written comments, because a federal PAC operating in the state in support of or opposition to state-level candidates is defined in law, and there is plenty of case law to support this as a committee. So I'm concerned that removing federal PACs from the listing of committees under rule could be problematic. Can you address that?
Well, we don't have authority over federal PACs, so if they're operating in Colorado on an issue in Colorado, they'll have to register and report.
Okay. Well, there's of course a couple of cases proceeding on precisely that question, and the argument has been that because federal PACs may not be listed as committees under Colorado rules, that they're exempt from Colorado rules. Again, that's my concern, and that's why I strongly oppose the removal of federal PACs from the current list of committees that are subject to Colorado campaign finance law and Colorado campaign finance rules is very problematic. That would certainly lead to more unnecessary litigation when in law and in rule currently federal PACs are listed. And I believe the language also talks about, as you pointed out, if they're involved in an issue, then that federal PAC needs to register as an issue committee. If they are involved in supporting or opposing candidates, then that federal PAC needs to register as a political committee.
Right, or set up a separate committee.
Right. Committee, which would be fine. But if a federal PAC is operating without having done any of that, and the rule excludes them from the definition of committee, that can lead, I think, to some problematic issues of statutory and regulatory interpretation by the courts. In fact, that's something that is in current litigation as we speak. On two cases.
Well, but if they're only involved in a federal issue, then we don't have any ability to regulate.
Right, but the current rule, I believe, speaks to that and speaks to the fact that if they are involved in state issues or involving state candidates, then they are under Colorado campaign finance rules.
I just wanted to clarify for the record, federal PACs were removed from the rules in a previous rulemaking, so they have been removed from the rules for, I would say, a year or so now. And so that was all done in a previous rulemaking and is not subject to the rulemaking that we're talking about today.
Okay. Well, and that, again, my written comment applied to what was posted online before just 7 days ago. So. I do believe that omitting federal PACs from the listing of committees subject to Colorado campaign finance law is problematic, and will probably you'll have to revisit that issue as a result of court cases.
Okay.
Let's see. And again, I apologies for having to sort of scan through this as we're going because of the late notice. I think most of the most of the language here is cleanup, which is fine. And I believe the small-scale issue committee is in response to recent legislation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Is the threshold for small-scale committees adequately defined in legislation and statute?
It's 5,000.
Okay, which is it's good. I mean, that's a long overdue reform, actually, so no objection to that. Question on the amendment to Rule 9.2 regarding the resignation of the registered agent. The first two sentences, I think, are not problematic. In fact, I think it's good clarifying language. The final sentence, though, regarding a registered agent's name remains on file until the committee assigns a new registered agent if that registered agent resigns. How is that going to impact how that registered – if the registered agent resigned and basically said, nope, I'm done with this committee – that could impact things such as process of service. It could impact things such as accountability for the committee's actions. It could actually render it impossible to serve process on a committee that no longer has a registered agent on file. So I wonder if you could discuss that and how that is impacted by I mean, the current rule, I think, requires a committee to submit a new registered agent within 10 days on resignation of the current registered agent. So keeping the old registered agent on potentially beyond that 10 days when that registered agent has resigned and basically washed their hands of the committee could be problematic.
Do you want to answer?
So you're correct. The law does require a committee to have a registered agent. And so our office, it's difficult for us if a registered agent wants to resign. We can't then have a vacant spot, essentially.
Right.
So the onus is then on the committee, as you point out in the rules, for the committee to appoint a new registered agent. And until that time, we have to continue to use the old registered agent. Otherwise, that we can't permit a vacancy, essentially.
Okay. Amendments to Rule 10.7.2. This one is a new one and troubling as I read it, and perhaps you can put my mind at ease about it. The amended rule reads, anonymous contributions are contributions where the identity of the contributor and the new language is, or other required reporting information is unknown. There are a number of rules and statutes that refer to required reporting information. Everything from, obviously, the name of the contributor, the address of the contributor. In the case where the contribution equals or exceeds $100, their occupation and employer. So by adding this language, or other required reporting information is unknown, that would render that an anonymous contribution. I'm a little bit confused about that, and I think the implications of that may need to be discussed.
So you're concerned that you know the name, but you don't know the address, and this swallows up too many things?
Right. I mean, currently, if you get a contribution and you have the name and you don't have the other required reporting information, you are required to do your due diligence and find that. And if you can't, you're required by law, by statute, I believe, in some cases, and by rule in others, to return that contribution or to donate it to a charitable organization.
So you're saying it doesn't make it anonymous. You just think it's too broad of a...
I'm concerned that it could, yeah.
I got it. Okay.
And, I mean, the implications of that for, if you receive a contribution from someone, you know their name, you don't put down, for example, their occupation and employer, which is required by a statute. In fact, I think it's required under Article 7 or Section 7 of Article 28. If that somehow, if the rule somehow transforms that to an anonymous contribution, well, then the violation actually is submitting that contribution without that required information.
Yeah.
So that would shift the whole statutory and constitutional and regulatory implications of that contribution as a violation of certain sections of the Constitution by making it anonymous. Do you understand where I'm going with that?
Yeah. Well,
and I haven't fully thought through all the implications of this, but I'm concerned that needs to be fully discussed and fleshed out before that language is changed.
Okay.
That's fine. Ten point one seven. I think those are good changes, clarifying things and making things more clear, I think, for everybody. The electioneering communications section, this is one that has been sort of problematic going back and forth for a while. I believe my comments on that talked about some of the issues with that. So 11.2, we had the... And again, the addition of or regular biennial school electioneering communication, I think, is appropriate. I wonder also if that might be added to apply to municipal elections or coordinated elections that typically happen in the spring. Because as of now, the interpretation is that those elections and communications regarding those elections are not counted as electioneering communications. If you could talk to that.
I mean, this was just done to bring us in compliance with the recent legislation that was passed, so we're just adding the
The biannual election part.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think we're making any other changes to that section.
We're not. And who is required to, you know, report those electioneering communications is outlined in statute.
Right.
So we can't change that by rule. This particular part was added by legislation this spring.
Got it. And then one other issue that I had included in my written comments regarding 11.4, it also talked about 11.1, which is not on the list of current changes, but adding and method of communication following including name of candidates, I think, makes that consistent with remaining provisions of the electioneering rules. All of the electioneering statute and the requirements in the Constitution require both the name of the candidate referred to and the method of communication. So excluding that from Rule 11.4, I think, could lead to some divergent interpretation of what is an electioneering communication and what is required to be included on reports of electioneering communication, including, of course, the reports that are submitted as part of the normal report of contributions and expenditures or reports of donations and expenditures. So I think that ensuring that that method of communication language is included consistently throughout all the rules applying to electioneering communications is a necessary change and addition.
And just to if you look up at 11.2, the method of communication is required
exactly.
In that rule.
And that's why it should also be included in 11.4. Just for the sake of consistency, the requirements are the same and should be stated the same in each rule that applies to electioneering communications. That's really my only concern there. Because again, we've had cases where the respondents have argued, well, sure, it says in 11.2, but not 11.4, so it doesn't apply, which clearly it does. It is meant to apply throughout and should be applied consistently throughout, that electioneering communications require a standard set of information, regardless of what rule you're referring to. Let's see, that's not in this one, so I'll skip that. Question about deleting Rule 18.2. Can you discuss the impetus for that, why that rule is being deleted, and your thoughts on the implications of that for applying penalties and adjudicating violations of the statute and rule? And full disclosure, there's, of course, a case pending before the Colorado Court of Appeals which addresses precisely that issue. So I just want to make sure that the whatever rule change is made is going to be consistent with the court ruling.
Well, do you have a comment on it?
Well, I'm first, I'd like to understand why it is you're striking that rule. What's the intent behind that? What implications do you believe that that may or may not have?
Are we involved in that litigation?
That one, no. It's one of the few ones you didn't jump in on.
Yeah, I don't know if we're prepared to comment on what the implications of it are. Yeah.
And particularly my concern regards Rule 18.2.2, which is that particular point, that precise point, that precise language, in fact, is the subject of some of the deliberations of the Court of Appeals on this very issue, that no cure period under this rule applies to late filing of campaign finance reports subject to penalties under Colorado Constitution Article 28, Section 10.2 alpha. So there was a complaint. The ruling of the administrative courts was, yes, it was a violation. That ruling has been appealed to the Court of Appeals. The respondent appellant is arguing that they are entitled to a cure period, irrespective of whether or not in the first section, if, and again, by statute, whether or not anyone from the Secretary of State's office deems the report to be incomplete. And they are claiming that their due process rights were violated because they didn't get that additional, quote unquote, cure period to fix their violation.
So do you think we have authority for the rule to give people a cure period?
I don't believe that a cure period is warranted, certainly not for anything adjudicated in an administrative court hearing.
So would support striking it, wouldn't you?
Well, no, I think this clarifies that you don't have authority to apply a cure period, the rule as it currently stands. By striking that calls that back into question.
Well, we're striking all of 18.2, which provides for some cure period for other things, right?
Well, it talks about, and again, this the rule, I think, talks to the statutory language regarding whether or not the Secretary of State or someone in the office of the Secretary of State deems the report to be incomplete. And my understanding of that language is it dates back to the days of paper submission of reports, and the incomplete language deals with, oh, did I leave off a page or did I leave off a section, which is pretty much impossible with the current electronic filing system under TRACER. Currently, it's pretty much impossible to file a report that is incomplete, right, as defined in statute. But the argument being made in the court case is, well, since we didn't supply required information, that renders the report incomplete, which is, I think, ludicrous. Yeah. It simply requires the report deficient.
I'm just hesitant to comment because it's currently in litigation. I mean,
right.
If the rule is moot because you can't submit an incomplete report, then that may answer your question.
Right.
You know, if you think we don't have authority to decide, you know, to give people a cure period, then that may answer your question.
Well,
I'm just not sure I want to get into a dialogue over.
Fair enough. I believe that under the current statute, the current rule makes sense because of the language regarding deeming a report incomplete. So this 18.2.1 clarifies that, what does it mean to deem a report incomplete? And it talks about in the course of his ordinary course of his duties. Well, okay, that makes sense. That it also, I believe, both the statute and the rule frees you from the obligation, essentially, to review every report for content. The argument being made is that the Secretary of State essentially is obligated to review every single campaign finance report for content, which clearly is, A, not legal, it's not within your statutory or constitutional authority, and B, would be clearly impossible for the Secretary of State's office to actually carry out giving staffing levels. So imposing that mandate would require a ridiculous amount of person hours to be dedicated to reviewing each and every campaign finance report for content, which has never been the case. And that essentially is the argument being made. I think this rule clarifies that, well, no, it only applies if by happenstance, essentially, and that's what the statute says, that's what the rule clarifies, that if someone in the ordinary course of their duties happens to come across something and happens to notice it, then they have the authority to essentially reach out and say, hey, we noticed a goof, you might want to fix it,
yeah,
which I think is okay. But it's a different matter entirely, and this is addressed in Rule 18.2.2, where once a complaint is filed and the notice of the deficiency has been brought to the attention of the offending organization that, hey, guess what, we just caught you with your hands in the cookie jar, that clarifies that, you know, you don't get to just regurgitate the cookie and put it back in.
Right.
So, again, I think that my concern with that rule or striking that rule, I think, should probably await the ruling of the court in that case before any changes are made, because I believe that the current language clarifies and, frankly, absolves the Secretary of additional responsibility or additional work that would be required in the alternative interpretation of statute and the, I think, warped interpretation of the rules. Okay, written complaint is simply renumbering, so no issue there. And the amendment to Rule 21.1.2 Alpha, so I believe what you're trying to do there is simply make the language consistent where it talks about party elsewhere by striking committee and substitute party. Is that an accurate understanding?
That's correct.
Okay. Fair enough, and certainly no objection to that. And again, in my written comments, I had also included a couple of suggested amendments or additions to new language. I don't know if that's something you can that be discussed here at this time, or is that a subject for a different venue?
Well, if it's related to the notice.
What is related to the notice, although it relates to a different draft of the proposed rules, it talks about one of the proposed amendments or appending language on the third page of my written comments, Rule 18. I believe this would clarify the actual practice of the office of the Office of the Secretary of State. Suggested appending the language, quote, during the pendency of the appeal, the entry of judgment for the administrative law judge decision is considered delayed or suspended for the purpose of tolling the statute of limitations for enforcement of the ruling. I believe that speaks directly to your practice. It would simply codify that in written form.
Okay.
Comments or thoughts on that additional or proposed additional language?
Well, if the statute of limitation is related to a court enforcement, then we can't modify that by rule. If it's something that, you know, we can't delay what the district court's jurisdiction is. So when you say tolling the statute of limitations for enforcement, we can't toll, like if you wanted to go in and privately enforce in district court, we can't toll that period by rule. We can only toll.
Well, essentially, you do that already. This is simply codifying that, because under your current interpretation of the rules and the current practice, the Secretary of State does not even invoice for penalty until exhaustion of all appeals. So during the pendency of appeal, essentially, the entry of judgment is considered by the Secretary to be suspended. The additional language, the proposed additional language, simply codifies what has been existing practice for a number of years. It makes it clear, and that, of course, is the subject of the hearing today, is to clarify language in order to make it more transparent to the user.
I believe
that additional language would certainly make it more transparent, because that simply puts in writing what the current practice has been.
Yeah, I just think it's a little bit broad when you discuss the tolling of statutes of limitation and you don't limit it to the internal invoicing procedure. If there's a certain amount of time you have to go to district court to do a private enforcement, you know, we can't change the district court's jurisdiction.
But essentially you do already. This is simply putting that in writing.
Well, I don't know whether we do or not. I mean, that would be for a district court to say whether the fact that the secretary didn't invoice somebody for X amount of time told the statute of limitations or not. So I just think it's a little bit broad.
All right. Well, and we may have a court ruling that clarifies that in any case here within a few months. That concludes the comment that I have. Thank you for your time. Thank you for offering the opportunity for comment to be submitted both in writing and here today.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
All right. I don't see anyone else here to testify. So at this time, our office will take under advisement possible amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign and political finance rules. The record will remain open through close of business Tuesday, August 2nd, to allow the submission of additional written comments. That concludes today's hearing. The time is 9:35. Thank you.